Hello, my name is Hannah Dyson from Enfield Voices and Global Net 21. And this is one of the many webinar interviews we do each week, exploring local, national and international issues and focusing on extraordinary people doing their work and being carried out by inspiring individuals. Today, we are talking to former international footballer Tony Kelly about what drives him to educate young people and adults on the dangers of gambling. We will explore how Tony turned his life around to lead the battle against gambling addiction. And we will discuss Tony's personal journey, including recovery tools, and explore Tony's current work with Red Card and why it's important to educate young people and adults on the dangers of gambling. Statistics published by the gambling charity GamCare show that of the 38,404 calls received to its helpline between 2019 and 2020, 6 out of 10 were from people aged 35 or under. So this age group also makes more than half of those getting treatment, according to the National Gambling Treatment Service. And figures from the Gambling Commission from 2018 show that 1.7% of 11 to 16-year-olds in England, Wales and Scotland are classed as problem gamblers. So hi, Tony, and welcome to the webinar. Thank you very much for agreeing to be interviewed about this important subject.
Evening, Hannah. Good to be here. I just want to correct you on one thing. In terms of international football, I didn't play for England, but the international element is obviously playing football in the UK and in Sweden. Well, I left school at 16. Generally, the footballer's journey is, you know, you sign for an academy, maybe 10, 11 years old, get 16, and then you'll either be given a scholarship, or in my day, because I am older than I look, in my day it was an apprentice. So 16 to 18. And then you turn pro at 18 if you're lucky. So my journey was leaving school at 16, signing for Bristol City as an apprentice. But I was a little bit wild, unfortunately, as a 16, 17-year-old. And although I did create history in terms of becoming the youngest player ever to play for Bristol City's first team at 16 and 244 days, the future looked bright, but I was released actually from Bristol City at 17 because my, to be frank, my attitude wasn't quite right. And then I moved into what they call semi-professional football and signed for Dulwich Hamlet and played for local teams around here, such as Enfield Town, St Albans City in Cheshunt. And then I was fortunate to get another second opportunity to turn professional at 21 when I signed for Stoke City in the second division back in January 1990. And that was the start of my professional football career. But obviously, you know, during that time, the gambling addiction kicked in, and obviously we're going to talk about that in more detail.
I wanted to know, when did you first start getting into gambling? Did you start in a small way when you were playing football?
Yeah, you started like many people, young people that start gambling. Lots of different reasons. The reasons from my day are probably they are different to today, why young people start gambling. So lots of various different issues, whether it's to cope with stress, to cope with other issues, whether it's to do with poverty, whether it's curiosity, whether it's peer pressure. And obviously in today's life, we're talking about advertising and promotion, which is a big push for young people getting involved in gambling. For me, I was 18 years old when I signed for Dulwich Hamlet, and mine was a combination of two things, I'd say. One was peer pressure. So I wanted to fit in. I wanted to have a sense of belonging. There was a group of older players that were doing football accumulators before the match on a Saturday. There was a bookmakers across the road called Mecca Bookmakers. Never forget it. And I wanted to feel part of a group, so to speak. So joining with them. I come from Coventry to London. I was a bit shy, etc. And so, yeah, I just wanted to fit in. I thought if I can just join in with these guys and, you know, go to the bookies before the game and have a £5 bet. That was my way of fitting in. And obviously there's the curiosity side of it and, you know, financial reward you hope to win. So that's how it all started. And it does start on a small scale. I always say to people, you never know where that first bet's going to take you. But yeah, the first £5 accumulated, five aways, never won. That should have been a lesson. But anyway, yeah. And that's how it all started.
Yeah. And I guess being an ambitious footballer, didn't really kind of think of the dangers of gambling. As you say, you wanted to fit in. When did you, when was it a big problem? Was it after you left football? Did it get, when you had the uncertainty of, you know, changing career, that type of thing?
Well, it's interesting about careers and about money, etc., because one of the things that is categorically true is that it doesn't really matter what you do for a living. It doesn't matter about your background or your status, whether I was a professional footballer or whether I was on Universal Credit or whether I was the university student. It doesn't, it's quite irrelevant. The gambling harm can be the same for each individual. So it started to escalate, like most people's gambling journey. It escalates, it creeps upon you, and then there comes a point where it starts to affect you on a daily basis. And by that I mean it consumes you, basically. So for me, I started taking money out of my wages, and then borrowing money off friends and family. And then eventually you get to a point where what we call in the industry chasing your losses, because when you start accumulating debt, then obviously you want to get out of that debt. And the only way to get out of that debt is to gamble, continue gambling, because it's now consumed you. You're now in the grip of an addiction. So when I signed for Stoke at 21, although I wasn't an addict, I had a gambling problem, because those 3 years from 18 to 21, I was gambling. And so, yes, I had a lot more money when I signed for Stoke and became a professional footballer. I had a lot more money, but with that comes a lot more risk, because, you know, your layouts are bigger, and which means the losses are bigger. And so, yeah, it's just a gradual escalation. And then that gets to a point where, as I said before, it consumes you and it becomes a compulsion. And you start to depend on it. And once you start to depend on it, i.e. you need to get to the bookies every day, you need to get to the casino every day, then you've got a serious problem. And that's what happened to me. It just basically took over my life, you know, throughout, from the time I turned professional to the end of my professional football career, which was ended really early. And when I say that, I mean, I lost 5 or 6 years to the game, because I finished professional football at 30, as opposed to 36, 37. And that was all due to my mental health issues and sporadic form. We talk about how it affects people within the workplace or within university or whatever, or school. It affected me on the football pitch and throughout my career. So, yeah, I finished football early, and the gambling obviously continued even after my football career.
And so in the fight back against that, how did you seek help, or how did you overcome this situation? Had a real grip on you, and how did you sort of fight back?
Yeah, well, for the one thing I want to point out about the whole addiction in general as well, before I talk about the recovery, is that, you know, we have to remember that we're not just talking about the individual gambler. So the impact it had on, you know, my family in particular is huge, because they go on the journey with you. So whether it's brothers and sisters bailing you out, parents bailing you out, lending you money, etc., then that creates conflict, and that creates, you know, divisions between, you know, family and friends. I've lost a few friends along the way, letting people down. Then you've got your kids, where you let your kids down, whether it's Christmas or birthdays, etc., and you've blown the gambling money. And obviously, you know, you're putting your kids at risk of being homeless, because I had my house repossessed, and that's happened to a lot of people I've met within the industry, ex gamblers, lived experience people that have suffered horrendous impact. So yeah, there's a bigger picture. I think that's one of the things I want to make clear. There's a bigger picture. It's not just about myself and my gambling harm, but also those around me. And the recovery, I always say to people, there's not one size fits all. It's as simple as that. Everybody recovers, you know, whatever addiction it is, everyone recovers differently in their own way. Some things suit others. And obviously the first thing you've got to do is acknowledge you've got a problem. I think that's the hardest part. That is actually the hardest part, because as gamblers, we are continually in denial, and we stay in denial for many of us for years and years and years. And generally speaking, majority of problem gamblers will only, you know, acknowledge they've got a problem and seek help when they've hit rock bottom. And that's a real shame, because that's what generally happens. I don't want to go on.
What did your family say at the time? Did they give you any kind of indication that they were worried? Did they sort of say, "Oh, please get help," or like, how did that manifest itself with people around?
Well, my friends, yeah, definitely. Be careful with your gambling. And there was always words of encouragement and warning signs from family members saying you want to cut down on your gambling. They knew I gambled, but they never ever knew to, you know, I'll go on to the start of recovery in a minute, but they never ever knew the extent of my gambling. So they never knew about the 32 creditors that I had when it came to bankruptcy in 2010. They had no idea. And that's because, you know, there's the stigma still attached, there's the guilt still attached, the shame, all that comes with gambling addiction. So they were never aware of the extent of my gambling addiction. They knew I gambled and they said words of warning, but they never actually knew the extent of my gambling until 2014, 13, 14, which is when I decided to go public with my story. Before that, 2010, I was bankrupt with £192,000 bankruptcy file, which is involved 32 creditors. And as I said before, that's all borrowing from every agency there is. And then I got to a point, 2013, 14, where, it's strange really, because I never envisaged or never thought about or anything about writing a book or books, but my sister was the head teacher and we had a chat because there was some stuff coming out on in the media about ex-footballers gambling. And she said, you should just put your story to print. And I said to her, well, I wouldn't know where to start. So, but she said, just write a paragraph, you know, a chapter, you know, send it to me. And I'd done that with my A4 paper and biro. And she said, we turned into biography from 9 years old, growing up in Coventry, you know, trying to be a professional footballer, the rejections, and then going through the addiction, et cetera. And so she liked it and she said, you can do this. And I, from that moment onwards, I couldn't stop writing. Our counsellors and therapists that I work with say that it can be very, you know, therapeutic and cathartic. So, and it was, because I couldn't stop writing. 18 months later, I have my manuscript and we sent it to publishers. And fortunately, it got published in 2014, which is called Red Card. So that was the start in terms of going public, because now I've got that weight off my shoulder in terms of everybody knows, family, friends, the media, everybody knows now. So that's what I wanted. That's what I really wanted. And that was me saying, right, okay, I've got a problem. I've got to address it. Everybody knows now. I've got that weight off my shoulder. And it was a question of what next. And that's when the idea came to set up Red Card Gambling Support Project in 2015, which is an organization I founded. And we're all about education, awareness and prevention. So that's how the project started, and that was the start of the recovery. So there was no GA, there was no CBT therapy. There was counselling. I had counselling for 6 weeks, but the counselling was also not just about the gambling addiction. It was about the whole of my life and where I was at and the future and hope and those kind of things. So that helped me. And then obviously, unfortunately, some of us haven't got big families. So that support network for some is not so great. So if you're, you know, a single individual with no brothers or sisters, that's really not much support network, then it can be difficult. But I've got 5 brothers and a sister. And to this day, they have supported me. And more so from 2015 today, they've been a huge support and proud of where I've got to. So, yeah, my story is, you know, happily enough, it ends with hope for many. So, yeah, the project started 2015.
And nowadays, with Card, you kind of, that's like a project where you're going into schools and you also talk to adults and with workshops, and you're kind of like educating. Yeah. Do you think it's really important to educate young people, possibly from sort of GCSE A level age, to sort of be aware of the dangers of gambling? I mean, for example, a lot of young people are into football. They could easily, you know, £10 at the weekend for football. That could maybe, you know, university when they're on their own might could be a tell us a bit about your workshops with young people and with Red Card.
Yeah, well, the model that we adopted was, and it's interesting because before I came on here to speak to you, I was listening to a podcast from a Labour MP, Alex Lewis. And really interesting, because one of the things that he's keen about, which he mentions a lot, is early intervention. And that is our model. That is Red Card's model, early intervention. And when we're talking about young people gambling today, the problem we have is that we've got to the point where it is gambling is normalised. It's as simple as that. It's just normalised for young people. And we have to sort of change the narrative of that. And we have to educate and raise awareness of where gambling can lead you to. You know, the pitfalls, the warning signs, the dangers, the impact that it can have on not only their lives, but people around them. So we're not about telling people you can't gamble. That's we're not anti-gambling. You know, I've said it many times. You know, millions of people gambling without ever encountering gambling harm. There's a social element to it. Day out at the races, night out at the casino. You know, so that's not what we're about. We're about intervention and educating people from young. You say about GCSE levels, and yes, we go into schools from 11 years old. We were in Surrey last week, Heathside School. We go all over the country. So we've got Birmingham. We're in Oldham 3 weeks ago. We go everywhere, and it's always from 11 years old upwards to up to 18. Sixth form students we've got in a couple of weeks. So, yeah, it's that age group, 11 to 18, is really, really important. And it's even more so important now because, yes, the figures are growing in terms of 65,000, you know, 11 to 16-year-olds, problem gamblers in the UK as we speak, and many more at risk. But the one thing that's crept into this industry is the correlation between gaming and gambling. And that's a big problem. You know, we done a workshop last week, and it was really engaged in terms of listening to 15, 16-year-olds talking about how they spend money on gaming, i.e. FIFA packs, loot boxes, etc. And so, but they don't actually realize it's gambling until we explain it to them. You know, where there's money spent in in-game purchases and where there's a risk and reward element, it's classed as gambling. It's just that it's not officially classed as gambling by the Gambling Commission. And this is something that's going to change, I think, in the near future, it's particularly with the Gambling Act that has just, Gambling Act Review of 2005, which has just finished. The consultation's finished on March the 31st. And two of the things in terms of young people that they're looking at is the loot boxes and the classification of gambling, and also the advertising and promotion of gambling, which is absolutely rife. And again, the young people, you know, told us that the amount of advertising that they get on their phone on YouTube and Instagram, etc. So the advertising is another big problem in terms of exposing young people to gambling and drawing young people into gambling.
Yeah, that must start at quite an early age, because a lot of young people now have phones, or they might have access to phones from the age of 10, 11. And as you say, they start
On that, 73% of 11, 16-year-olds have a mobile phone. So, yeah, you're correct.
And then, yeah, I mean, as you say, you know, it can be the sort of way of, you know, it's not always a problem, but when do you think it does become a problem? I mean, do you think it's a certain way, you know, maybe where you live in areas of deprivation, or if you have, you know, things like advertising or betting shops near schools?
Well, in terms of the demographics, yes, that's an important part. I mean, what happened in 2005 with the Gambling Act, I think Blair was in then, that's why after that we've seen this influx of gambling betting shops that opened up on our high streets. And when I say, obviously they've always been on our high streets, but what happened is that there was a massive influx where you got 7 or 8, 9, 10 on one high street. And what that was an opportunity for people to target certain areas. So I live in North London, so I'm aware of, you know, the deprivation that's in certain boroughs and certain areas where gambling bookmakers are situated. And that's been a deliberate target of the operators to, you know, put those gambling bookies within those areas, because obviously young people and older people, you know, for various different reasons, cultural reasons, poverty reasons, want to get out of poverty, think gambling's a way of enhancing their life, etc. So that's been a big problem. In terms of when, you know, people think they've got a problem, I think I've said it early in terms of when it starts to dominate your life and when it starts to cause you health issues, because, you know, I've worked with an advisory group, 16 of us working with the Gambling Commission, and some of the stories are horrific, but our journeys are similar in terms of, you know, gambling through the night, you know, not getting sleep, getting depressed, then obviously the financial stress and the debt, and then the issues with your partner. There's obviously other other issues like domestic abuse, etc., the effects on the kids. So when it starts to affect your daily life and affects you on a personal level, and you start to depend on it, just much like a drug or heroin addict or alcoholic, where they depend on it, then that's where the big warning sign is, where you actually start to depend on your gambling. The first thing you will think about in the morning is getting to the bookers or getting online, or you're gambling online through the night in Australia somewhere, because the markets are absolutely huge in terms of opportunity and accessibility. And that's something that's changed over the last 15, 20 years. That wasn't around in my day. So yeah, accessibility and opportunities is huge today.
Yeah, I mean, when I was looking at where exactly in Enfield the betting shops are, for example, so looks like there's a greater concentration of betting shops in Enfield are located along the Hertford Road corridor, with particular clusters in Edmonton Green, Enfield Town and Southgate. And then further away, significant clusters of betting shops are noted along Green Lanes and in the Bowes and Palmer's Green centres. So what do you think about
that? That just tells me that, you know, they're aware of the demographics. They're aware of the population of certain cultures within those areas, whether it's Black and Asian from the Caribbean culture, or the Muslim community, or whether it's the Turkish community. We know, through speaking to various people, that there's a big element of gambling within the Turkish community. So when you've just named those two areas, that just speaks volumes in terms of the population of those people that are in those areas. And it's no coincidence that the bookmakers, 6, 7, 8 on one street or in those areas. And, it's a shame that was allowed to happen back in 2005 with the Gambling Act. There was no risk assessments, etc. So it's a shame that was allowed to happen. But hopefully this Gambling Act review, which is just finished, there's going to be a lot. Well, we hope. I was part of the consultations with the Gambling Commission and the DCMS, and I think that there's two or three things that we think we might get over the line. One of them is shirt sponsorship in professional football, which is absolutely huge. When you go to a football match with your son and, the dad goes to the burger bar, there's always what we call stadia betting. So there's little bookmakers within the stadium in the stand, and your son is exposed to gambling while your dad's putting the bet on. The perimeter fencing, all the advertising around the pitch, and obviously shirt sponsorship. So all that they're looking at to change and get rid of shirt sponsorship. Because at the end of the day, professional football clubs, particularly in the Championship and Premier League, who have gambling sponsors, the Premier League, half the clubs are sponsored by gambling companies. The Championship, two-thirds, I think it's 17, are sponsored by gambling companies. So that relationship has to change, because they say they need the money, but they don't need the money. I know our professional football runs. I've been here long enough. They don't need the finances. That's just ridiculous. So I think that's one thing that will change and get banned. And then the classification of gambling in terms of gaming and gambling, that's going to be looked at, banning loot boxes. And obviously the other one is intervention, which is really interesting, because one of the common things that's come out of all the gamblers that I work with, ex-gamblers that I've worked with and listened to their horrendous stories, is the fact that throughout our journey, so looking at myself, and I've looked at old bank statements from 15 years ago, where you've got this constant stream of gambling transactions from my debit card, thousands. And we all ask ourselves, why didn't we get a phone call from the bank? Why didn't we get an email from the bank? Why was there no intervention? And that's the biggest thing that we all talk about now with the Gambling Act review. We need to get the banks to start not putting the onus on the consumer, i.e. us, where we can, with some banks, turn on and off a gambling block. But when you're in the depths of addiction, you ain't turning off no bank gambling block. So, the intervention needs to come from the banks, so they can intervene and make a phone call, send us an email, say, are you all right with your gambling? You've spent, £500 in the last 2 days, etc. Those kind of things. So intervention from the operators and the banks is something that the Gambling Act review, there might be some changes there. And then the last one, just touch upon quickly, is VIP scheme, which people won't know what that is. So when you're gambling, let's say a high earner, so to speak. It could be anything, could be a footballer, could be a banker, whatever it is, and you're gambling, you know, large sums of money, you'll be then invited to be a VIP. And what that means is that the operator, whether it's Bet365, but you know, William L. Labrador, whoever it is, will then, you know, basically give you incentives to keep betting, and free tickets to the football matches, free tickets to the races, hotel overnight stays, drop £1,000 in your bank account, free bets, you name it, they'll throw it at you as a VIP to encourage you to keep gambling. And we've heard lots of stories where one or two VIPs, I don't want to go too much into it, but one or two VIPs that we know personally have lost their lives to gambling addiction because they were bombarded with these enticements. So suicide, there is 650 gambling related deaths in the UK every year, two attempts to commit suicide every day. So we know the importance of suicide and gambling. There was a documentary 5 or 6 weeks ago from Ruth Davison on Channel 4, which a lot of people have come back to me and said that was important because it highlighted gambling and suicide to open people's eyes. So yeah, so there's a lot going on, and yeah, but fingers crossed, you know, things will get better, because all we're trying to do is make gambling safer. And I say that to, you know, people I work with, whether it's academics, whether it's lived experience, whether it's other agencies, whether it's the Gambling Commission. That's all I say to people. Collectively, we just want to make gambling safer.
No, definitely. It sounds like you're doing really, really good work going into school, having these workshops, you know, for young people. Why do you think those from Black and Asian community don't tend to talk about the issues of gambling? Do you think that's an issue, or and how do you see that? How do you think that should be tackled?
Yeah, it's an interesting point, because it's something that I've thought about for a while. When I came into this space, probably, 5 years ago, I never seen anyone of colour talking about gambling addiction or sharing their personal stories or anything like that. And I often wondered why. And it wasn't until we started to get involved in the work and then going to lots of conferences and lots of, you know, and having lots of debates and et cetera, then I started to realise that this is a bit of an issue. So I was fortunate enough to be, well, red card were, to be asked to be involved in a new project, which is basically preventing gambling harm in diverse communities. All the details on our website. This new project is unique and the first of its kind, and it's starting in August as we speak. It's a 2-year pilot for London and the Home Counties, and it's specifically for those from those communities, educating those from those communities. Because some research was done, there hasn't been a lot of research, but some research has been done, which says that 1 in 4 people from the main community are likely to suffer gambling harm. And so the reasons are because, generally speaking, we talked about, you know, the demographics in terms of the areas of deprivation and where the population of these people live and the reasons why they gamble, in terms of, you know, wanting to come out of poverty. And also the reason why they don't talk about that, the shame and guilt, you know, that is attached, and this stigma that is attached to gambling within these cultures and communities, that has to change. Because I remember, well, I've spoken to lots of people from the older generation as well, back in the 70s and 60s, you know, dads. So gambling within this particular Caribbean community has been around for a long, long time. It's just that it's not been talked about. And I've spoken to 60, 70-year-old people that are in serious trouble now, have lost the house, etc., from 30 years ago, that were gambling, but it's never been talked about. So I think me as a voice and others are starting to come into this space and raise awareness, and so that we can give people, basically give them more confidence that gambling, having a gambling addiction is okay. This happens to, you know, 600,000 people at the moment. So it's okay. So we just need to talk about it, continue to raise awareness. And hopefully this project will go a long way to doing that.
Yeah, because that's important, because if they're not talking about it, does that mean they're not getting help? And that sort of adds to the health inequalities.
I think that was one of the part of the research where the significant low percentage of people from these communities were not seeking help. And that's because they haven't got the confidence to go and seek help. And not only have many people from these communities not got the confidence to seek help, but they don't actually know where to go to seek help. So again, highlighting, you know, accessing support services is another part of the project that we do in terms of the workshops. And then you have the real cultural element to it in terms of those from, for instance, the Asian community and the Muslim community and the Hindu community. You know, these communities, you know, it's forbidden for certain parts of these people in these communities. Gambling is forbidden. So there is a massive, massive shame factor. There's a denial factor. It's hidden. That's why it's a hidden addiction. So there's a lot of people. We've met with a lot of people in these communities where gambling is going on through fear of being ostracized or, you know, shamed within the family. You know, these are the things that they're fearful of. So, yeah, it is going on. So we need to continue to raise awareness and educate those people from those communities, because I think gambling addiction, as I said before, affects everybody and anybody, regardless of race, background, and gender. And I'm trying to mention gender, actually, because, you know, there's a massive rise in women gambling. So, yeah, it's huge in every aspect, really.
Yeah, you're doing really, really amazing work, with the educational workshops with Red Card. How do you see that?
Sorry, Hannah. I will say one thing I forgot to mention regarding the new project for the diverse communities. The workshops will be free. Well, they are free. Yeah. So any organisation, they can find all the details on the website. And so whether it's staff, whether it's clients, whether it's organisations, youth organisations, whatever it is, those workshops for those communities are going to be free. I just wanted to make sure that so people know they're aware where they can book a workshop for free.
And if people want to know more about your work, should they go onto your website? How can they sort of get to know a bit more about your work? Would the website be the best way?
Yeah, the website's the best way. And also, if they put in Tony Kelly gambling, you'll get pages and pages of stuff and videos and interviews, etc. And there's videos and interviews on the website. So yeah, everything's there. Easy accessible, I am.
What's your plan next 5-year plan for your work and your projects? Where would you like to see it going, ideally, both personally?
I think personally I want to grow Red Card and probably work with other partners, because we've been going 6 years now. We obviously are the IC company, so we rely on funding and donations. So we're going okay in terms of people we've reached. We've gone past the 3,000 young people mark, which is great, but there's a lot more work to do. So ideally, I would like to see the BAME project, the pilot, be successful, because it's a 2-year pilot. And then what we hope to happen in terms of the conversations we'd have with the Gambling Commission is that if it is successful, then it will be rolled out nationally, because I come from the Midlands and the thousands and thousands of young people from the Black and Asian community in Birmingham and Leicester and Coventry, etc. Massive, massive gambling problem. But we want to roll it out nationally as opposed to just London and the home counties. And then, we just want Red Card to be at the forefront of education awareness and continue to grow the organisation and continue to reduce gambling harm, because that's the vision and the mission. Is basically to continue to reduce gambling harm. As I said from the start, you know, it's not about stopping people from gambling. It's about raising awareness of the impact it can have on individuals and their families.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Tony, for talking to me today. It's been really interesting to get to know, you know, about what's behind your passion for this work and what sort of, you know, all the workshops that you're doing. Thank you very much for taking the time.
I just want to say sorry to stop you, Hannah. Sorry to stop you. I don't want to forget, because I'm going to Coventry tomorrow to do another big podcast, and I always never forget any media stuff to do or anything. I just have published my second book, which was published on May the 1st, which is fantastic for me. As I said, I never thought in a million years that I would become an author of two books. But that's been published on May the 1st. That's available on Amazon and Foyles Books and W.A. Smith and Waterstones everywhere. That's called Red Card, A Bet You Can Win. And I love that title. I love that title because it's all about, this book is to the present day, and it gives people hope about coming out of adversity and trauma, that we can come out the other side. So, yeah, I just thought I'd mention that.
And just briefly, what's the difference between the two books? Is the first
good question.
Book-
The first book is obviously my whole journey from 9 years old, growing up in Coventry, etc. But it ends in 2014. The actual book ends in 2014, the story. So people kept saying to me, the more I grew into this space and started working with government, etc., people were saying, oh, people will wonder what's happened in Tony in the last 7 years. So I thought, you're right. So a lot has happened in the last 7 years because Red Car Gambling Sport Project wasn't born. So the second book is a sort of slightly edited version of the first up to 2014, but then it takes in the last 7 years of what I've been doing since Red Car Gambling Sport Project was born and all the stuff I've done in the last 7 years to the present day. Yeah. And as I said, it is yeah, generally about hope. Yeah. And unfortunately, that I was able to come out the other side. So yeah, all is not lost.
And that's why we've called this webinar, you know, Kicking Out Gambling Addiction. You were literally, obviously, that was, you know, a big part of your life, kicking and playing football, kick the football.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
To, you know, personally kick out your gambling addiction, but also others. I think it has been on a real journey.
I think it probably is. I think that because we talk about it with our groups and that you can always have a relapse. I think 2017, I think I had a little 200. I remember having a bet £200, not £200, but £5, but turning into £200. And so everybody, I think, you know, we talk about other addictions with alcohol and drugs and all that. And I think that is the danger, the relapse. And that's why, you know, part of our resources in terms of there has to be self-regulation as well as getting professional support. You know, I told you I had my counselling, and I'm lucky I've got to a place where I'm today, and I'm debt free, and I look after the organisation. I have to pay people and all that stuff, so I've got a lot of responsibility, and people have trust me now, which is great. So I've got to a good place, but you always have to be mindful that don't have a relapse. It could be anything that triggers it. It could be, you know, something personal in your life, you know, a bereavement, anything like that. So, yeah, that's why we put our self-regulation tools in place in terms of blocking yourself from gambling apps and blocking yourself from bookmakers, all those kind of things. And everybody can do that. And we always say to people that, you know, you can't just rely on the industry to protect you, yeah, because the industry will protect you to a certain degree, but you have to protect yourself as well.
No, definitely. Well, you're doing a fantastic job, and thank you very much for opening up and talking about this very, very important subject this evening, Tony. And yeah, thank you for your time, and we'll end this webinar now.